My point in teaching these lectures for this occasion is to try to explain the modern culture of our time as the open conflict of only two religions as they meet up together. I'm trying to simplify, but hopefully not be simplistic, in trying to understand what actually makes this particular culture tick. And you know, I come to you as someone who has seen something of the progression of this culture. I've seen massive changes. I first came to the USA in 1964 on a different plane, I use that word in two senses, than the Beatles. And I was a friend of John Lennon, so we were on different planes in a number of ways, if you see what I mean. And I've watched how Western culture has changed from that period till now. You know, I never saw John Lennon again after we left school at 16 years of age. I never saw him when I came to the States in 64, but I did meet somebody very important, a sort of a geeky guy with black-rimmed glasses and a crew cut at the school where I was, and he seemed so popular, so many students around him, a young fellow. I thought he was a visiting Roman Catholic scholar because everybody was calling him R.C. You get that? And so since 1964, we have been friends in the same combat. And I feel very honored to be able to do this series of lectures, and I, in a sense, dedicate them to his great contribution to the Christian faith in our time. When I came to America in the 60s, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. As a European, it seemed to me that you could never imagine a culture more Christian than the culture of America in 1964. But against all odds of what I would ever have dreamed possible, this particular culture is now rejecting the Christian faith that I saw so much in evidence when I came in 1964. Something has happened. A radical Marxist feminist historian from Harvard, her name is Elizabeth Fox Genovese, who was part of the 60s revolution, at the end of her life, converted to Roman Catholicism. And this is what this historian says. Within a remarkably brief period has occurred a cataclysmic transformation of the very nature of our society. Isn't that interesting? This particular observer of the culture described what happened in the 60s as a cataclysmic transformation. In other words, what happened in the 60s is not the typical passing on of traditions from one generation to the next, which always occurs with some kind of conflict. This is special. Something strange happened. But what we must avoid, I think, in trying to come to grips with this is nostalgia for the good old days, the pre-60s, the 50s, if you like. It's true that prior to the 60s, the West lived under what sociologists call the sacred canopy of a biblical worldview. People were not necessarily Christian, but their presuppositions about the nature of existence, what did it mean to be a male or a female, what was true or false, right or wrong, were defined by the biblical tradition from hundreds and hundreds of years of tradition. But now that canopy is being ripped away. It's never happened before in 1700 years. That's why I think the term cataclysmic transformation is appropriate. The plausibility structures that dominated the West when I came in 64 have been redefined really beyond recognition. God is now polytheism, many gods. Morality is relativism. It's certainly not Christian morality. Sexuality is omnigender. Gone is the simple heterosexual norm. Family is any combination of people and genders. Marriage is now extended to same sex, and we're seeing on the horizon polygamy. Motherhood includes abortion on demand. Spirituality is do-it-yourself Eastern mysticism. Now, I watched this happen in the space of one generation. 3 years ago, I gave a lecture at the West Coast Ligonier Conference entitled The Gnostic Gospel. I had published a book, the title of which I'm very proud, The Gnostic Empire Strikes Back, in 1992. As when I came to the States, I went through culture shock. What I'd known in 64 was no longer clearly the case. Something was happening. And so I wrote that book, The Gnostic Empire Strikes Back, because I began to realize that what was happening was not really something new, but something old represented as new. It was the old Gnosticism, but now supposedly in new dress. It was called the New Age movement. You remember Shirley MacLaine went on television and said, "I am God," in her book, Going Within. Well, you know, as soon as people claim to be God, you can tell that what is happening really is a fallback to paganism, which is another, well, Gnosticism is an expression of generalized paganism. And it brought me to the text of Scripture, which I'd read many times. Romans 1:25. They exchanged the truth of God for the lie. So here we have the identification of two kinds of truth. One isn't the truth. Worshipping and serving the creature rather than the Creator who's blessed forever. Do you see that? A simple distinction that Paul gives us. He's telling us there are only two religions, right? I didn't invent this stuff. I wouldn't dare to. But Paul is actually saying here, when you look at it, there are only two ways of being a human being on this earth. You either worship the creation or you worship the Creator. I'd read that many times, but it suddenly hit me with this onrush in Christian America of Gnostic paganism that indeed Paul was right 2,000 years ago in what he said. And I tried to think of a way of describing it. You know, I used terms like Gnosticism, paganism, and then I came to see the term monism, but my wife, who's much more intelligent than I, said, "Why don't you just drop the M from monism, which means all is one, and everyone will understand?" So I did. So we get the term oneism, you see. And that's paganism. Paganism is oneism. It's the worship of creation, where everything is one. Everything is of the same nature. Everything really shares the same substance. That's why the term one is used. And of course, that includes everything, rocks, trees, human beings, and God. God is included. It's wonderfully spiritual, by the way, but it actually reduces God to a piece of creation, if you see what I mean. He's the spirit within things. The other I call twoism, because as Paul says, and if Paul is true, then what is true about existence is that there is creation, and then there's the Creator who is radically different than creation. The watchmaker is different from a watch, right? You don't confuse them. And this is the case. God and creation are distinct, which means there are two kinds of existence, not one. Hence the term, you've got it, twoism. At the risk of being terribly oversimplified, I think that these terms help us look around and identify what's happening in our culture, even in the church. And as a matter of fact, we're used to thinking about that in spiritual terms, but really you have all kinds of oneisms. You have materialistic oneism, as in Marxism, as in atheism, because you see, in those systems that are not particularly spiritual, they still try to identify the world by the world itself with no reference to any power outside. So they are oneist as well, if that's helpful. As I begin to think about this, I found one and two popping up everywhere. Colin Gunton considered by some one of the most important British theologians of his generation. He died in 2003. Without using this terminology, said this: there are probably ultimately only two possible answers to the question of origins, and they recur at different places in different ages. And here they are. Either that the universe is the result of creation by a free personal agency, God, or that in some way or other it creates itself. See, there are only two possibilities. Isn't that interesting? Have you ever thought of that? Only two possibilities. Either God creates or reality creates itself. The two answers are not finally compatible, obviously, and require a choice, either between them or an attitude of agnostic refusal to decide. As I pored through countless books trying to identify what this one-ism is, I kept meeting the use of the terms one or two. A history of religion scholar in 1962, Mircea Eliade, he was a Romanian, published a study of world religions. Guess what the title is? The Two and the One. In 1978, a world traveler, a Christian observer, Ernest Steed, went through the world, I think, about eight times studying religions. You know the title of his book? The Two Be One. Without knowing that, I actually published a book in 2010 with the title One or Two, Seeing a World of Difference. Beyond book titles, I really discovered the importance of these simple concepts of one and two and how they play a role in the way people think of religion. I studied Gnosticism as a student at Harvard, and one of the Gnostic texts, the Gospel of Thomas, which is often now attempted to be proposed as an important gospel as the four canonical gospels, which is not true, says this: when you make the two one, and when you make the inside like the outside, and the outside like the inside, and the above like the below, and some of you who've studied witchcraft know that that term, as above, so below, is absolutely essential. It's been that way for thousands of years. And when you make the male and the female one, are we doing that today? And the same, then you will enter the kingdom of heaven. You see that playing with the notion of one or two and reducing two to one being the absolute essence of paganism. This spirituality, which has developed in our time and is now called progressive spirituality and delves into Gnosticism, since those Gnostic texts have been proposed as valid for the contemporary world. Progressive spirituality talks about the goal of its thinking as non-dual consciousness. What does non-dual mean? Not two. It's one. Non-dual consciousness, you'll see this all over the place. Remember, it's one-ism. So non-dual is good, and anything else, namely duality or twoism, is bad. This is the conflict in which we find ourselves. And indeed, I found the title and listened to a lecture by one of the leading progressive thinkers in 2012. And here's the title: The Significance of Non-Duality. There is only one, not two. And as I listened, this man, Andrew Cohen, kept asking, why is it important that there is only one, not two? For him, this is the essence of the spiritual struggle in which we find ourselves today. I'm trying to fill in this notion for you by an appeal to these various expressions of this seemingly simplistic way of looking at life, right? In one sense, it's good. It's simple. The Bible is simple. It's deep, but it's simple. And Paul was right that this is the conflict. The conflict today actually is shown by a book by Philip Goldberg, obviously raised a Jew, who recently, actually in 2013, produced a book, American Veda. Now, Veda is Indian philosophy. And he argues that America has become Hindu. And the particular and fundamental notion that has been proposed throughout recent times, he says, is the fundamental Hindu notion in Sanskrit. Here's what it is, Advaita. I should write that on the board. This is an important term. Advaita. You know what it means? Specifically, in Sanskrit, it means not to. Isn't that interesting? That the ideology that this man says is taking over America is the ideology of not two, namely one. All is one. Some of you very intelligent listeners are already asking, how does Islam fit? I'm getting nodding. I'm glad I thought of this. Because in a way, you see, Islam would seem to be part of twoism, right? It expresses God who is distinct from us. But I guess in a certain way you could describe it as a false twoism, but it is also a false twoism that is so much a oneness system that one has to wonder if it will end up there anyway. Because you see, Allah is a monad or a singularity. A singularity is the very essence of one. He has no other to which to relate. So he's in a very oneness situation. There's no one else but Allah. He cannot know anything other than himself. He cannot know what philosophers call the subject-object distinction, because he's one and only one. Of course, that makes Allah radically impersonal, right? To live forever as one is no way of having a personal relationship with anything. Now, the way that Islam solves this problem of the impersonality of Allah is in two ways. First of all, the Sufis, who are the spiritual Islamists, argue that Allah is everything, and we are everything too, so we're all personal, you see. But of course, that means that Allah and we are the same, which makes that a oneness system. And indeed, many, many people today are converting to Sufism because it is so oneness. Now, the Orthodox Muslim scholars argue in a different way. They don't like the Sufists. But they do say that for Allah to be personal, he had to create us. Which means, of course, that one of the fundamental attributes of Allah is dependent upon us. So that Allah is dependent upon the creation, which is precisely the essence of oneism. In great contrast, of course, the God of the Bible is a Trinity. And this is absolutely essential because, you see, God can be three and thus be personal in his very essence and know the other, the three persons of the Trinity. In this sense, of course, God is the source of twoism. I know we're getting mixed up with two and three, but the point is, twoism is the fact that there is an other that's distinct and yet there is personal communion and unity. That's what twoism really is. So, the truth of existence is that God is the source of twoism in his own being. For spiritual oneism, twoism is the great problem. Will these two systems of Islam and Eastern paganism either fuse or be radically in conflict? That's not for me to say. I have a hunch that Islam, being so fundamentally false, will end up as a pagan system like all the others. Rabbinic Judaism has some of those tendencies, by the way. So, what are we facing in our day? A culture making regrettable mistakes of moral laxity that eventually will right itself as the good sense of the American heartland reasserts itself? Or something far more sinister? A whole new redefinition of civilization built on the lie that nature is God. Melanie Phillips, the British journalist, a Jewish woman, understands. The attack on Western civilization, at its most profound, she says, is an attack on the creed that lies at the very foundation of that civilization. The very creed. What is that creed? Well, we have it summed up in Romans, of course, the worship of the Creator, and in the Apostles' Creed. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. So here is what is coming, it seems to me, a denouement, as the French say, between these two ways of looking at things. But this redefinition of civilization has the wind in its sails right now. What kind of a civilization elevates a man like the San Francisco politician Harvey Milk, guilty of horrendous crimes of sexual predation, to a place of public honor with a state holiday, his own commemorative stamp, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom? What kind of a civilization raises such an icon for the next generation to follow? Al Mohl has recently come out and said, in one single generation, this revolution is taking its place of power in our world. He speaks about a moral revolution at warp speed. There's something darkly bizarre about this pansexual agenda. How is it happening so fast? And what do Christians do? Our calling, I believe, is not to nostalgic hand-wringing for an idealized past, but to identify the root ideology in order to speak clearly the gospel in this time. And so I encourage you, dear friends, to try to understand what's happening in order that we can speak clearly the gospel, which is the very opposite of what we see. Try to understand the culture, what makes it tick, so that the gospel may be clearly heard. Thank you very much.